So we're looking at the De Broglie bone model, and where I stopped last time was we were seeing how to sketch trajectories in this model. And there were two, two principles that you can use to sort of get a sort of idea how to sketch trajectories. This is a kind of heuristic, really. One was the no crossing. In configuration space. Principle, and the reason for that is that the velocity in configuration space is a single valued function of the position in configuration space, given the wave function. So x dot is some function. So this is the x for all the particles. I'm not sure if I said this last time. This is a curious departure from classical dynamics. In classical dynamics, the initial momenta, or initial velocities, and the initial positions are all independent, and you can choose them separately. Whereas in a De Broglie-Bohm model, the initial positions and the initial wave function are things that can be set, and then the velocities are determined. You don't have freedom then to determine the velocities.
So how would you recover here that in classical mechanics there is crossing in configuration space?
Oh, right, okay. That's a good question. I hadn't thought about that before. The taking the classical limit is a slightly problematic subject in quantum foundations. However, one thing you could think about is, you know, typically you would want to say, you know, in you'd want it to be the case that under some limits, you know, if you have a particle, then the average behavior of your wave packet is behaving somehow classically, and there's like things like Ehrenfest theorem and so on to try and establish that works. And so in the De Broglie-Bohm model, you might have, here's an example, you might have a wave packet here and a wave packet here. In quantum theory, you might have a wave packet here. And then these two wave packets would intersect. And if you start off just with this term and you have no wave function there, then the particle will end up here. A detector here will fire for certain. And likewise, if you start just with this term, this detector will fire. And then if you start off, if you have both of these in equal amplitude, then you'll have both detectors fire. And it will be, you know, it will be as you'd expect. Like, you know, if you took some kind of classical limit, then you just get, even if you don't take a classical limit, you'll just get 50%, 50% here. And so you can just interpret that as if to say the particle goes along here and reaches this detector. That would be a natural interpretation in a sort of classical limit. However, in the De Broglie-Bohm model, what's actually happening is the particles here are bouncing off. So they don't cross. There's no experiment you can do to actually verify this. So it's as if they crossed from the point of view of any experiment you can perform. However, if you do the detailed calculation, these particles end up not crossing. And if you look inside this region where the two wave packets are overlapping, there's lots of interference, and that interference causes the guidance equation to push the particles away. So they don't overlap, as indeed they have to not overlap because of this property. So I think the real answer to your question is at the statistical level, even before you take the classical limit, you're not seeing any evidence for crossing. However, at the level of the detailed calculation in the Du Broglie model, there is. So you are, at the statistical level, you are seeing the evidence of crossing. Whereas in the Du Broglie model, at the deep level of detail calculation, there is non-crossing. Just like in the Du Broglie model, if your wave function is in equilibrium, sorry, if your distribution is in equilibrium, so it's equal to the wave function, the modulus of the wave function squared, then although there is non-locality, you can't see it. It's masked by the quantum, the averaging in the quantum distribution. So this is also masked. Okay, and then the other principle, so sketching, the other principle is that rho is equal to psi squared. So if this is true initially, then it must be true all the way through. So you want your trajectories to sort of to make sure that they have this property. And I showed you a very simple example where you have just a Gaussian sort of moving in this direction. And then later on, the Gaussian is here and it might have spread out a bit. And the trajectories will just travel sort of like so. And they will spread out a little bit because the Gaussian is wider and they don't cross. Here's another example. If you have a barrier, so you have this is the situation, you have some potential barrier, and then you have a wave, you have a Gaussian, which is impinging on that barrier. Depending on the height of this barrier, some part of the wave function will tunnel through the barrier, and some part of it will be reflected off. So you'll have if I can draw it in space and time, if your barrier is here, some initial wave function comes in here. Let's just draw this barrier vertical. You'll have some part of the wave function will be reflected, and some part of it will be transmitted. And also, the wave function will spread out as well as it evolves. So there's an attempt to draw what's happening. So now we can draw the trajectories. I'll use this orange chalk. We have trajectories that are sort of at the beginning, at the front of this wave packet, which is going in that direction. So actually, I'm going to use white because it isn't very visible. So trajectories that are at the front of this wave packet. And then we have ones which are further back. This is not very good. Like so, and lots in between. Now, the ones that are at the front, if they get reflected, then they're going to have to cross some of the ones at the back. So the ones at the front have to go through and then also spread out as they go through. And then the ones at the back, a few more here. The ones at the back, they get reflected, but also you can see the other thing that's interesting is the order of them gets reversed. Let's draw one more. So the one that was at the very back here ends up being at the very front as the wave packet goes out. Hope that's visible. Okay. What you could do if you wanted would be to now put another barrier at each of the two sides, have an infinite potential barrier, which will now reflect these particles back, and then they will meet again this barrier, and then they will interfere, and you can vary the amount of interference by changing the path lengths and so on. And then, according to what phase you have, you'll have some number of particles still being reflected and some number of particles still being transmitted at the end, and you can recover quantum interference in that way. Okay. And then the sort of canonical interference experiment is the double slit interference. That's the one that everyone did when they were in high school or wherever, I don't know. Let me just hand out some of those. If you could pass a chunk of those to people behind.
Thanks.
Maybe pass those back as well behind you. So this is the calculation of the particle trajectories for a double slit interferometer. So you can see, just hold this here. You can see that you have, you know, you have a source of particles coming in, and then there's a barrier. It's got two slits in, so that only allows particles to go through these two slits. Also, the wave function is evolving as well. So the wave function hits these two slits and diffracts out behind after each slit. Eventually, those wave functions meet and they start interfering. Okay. So what happens? Let me just talk through this picture. Actually, this picture. Well, not that this one was from this paper in 1979, but there was an earlier version of this done in the in the 60s. By a student of David Bohm. So David Bohm wrote down the de Broglie-Bohm model in 1952, and then he kind of forgot about it, or lost interest in it. And then one of his students, Chris Dewdney, who's also one of the authors on this, did some computer simulations. I think this was in probably the late 60s. Now back then, to do a computer simulation was a non-trivial task. And so the way he did it was he wrote his code. The code was punched into pieces of card, like holes. You know, you have those. The old computers had the program was fed into the computer with pieces of card with holes in, and then that ran the program. And so it was a very non-trivial calculation. Even something very simple like this. Now you can program this on your computer, on any computer, and it will run in a fraction of a second. It was this picture that convinced David Bohm to take seriously again the de Broglie-Bohm model that he had played a role in inventing. Okay, so the wave functions go through, and then the particles come through. So it's a few things that are interesting. So you see, if a particle comes through the slit here on the left, then it doesn't cross over to the right. Okay, because of the no crossing principle. And likewise, if a slit comes through on the right, it won't cross over to the left. These trajectories initially spread, are traveling along pretty much along straight lines. But then when the wave packet from the other slit reaches here, then you can see the trajectory start to jiggle. And now if you take a cross section at any sort of given time, any distance from that slit, you can see you'll have an interference pattern. So here, you know, here you have the intense part of the pattern in the middle, and then you have, you know, some gaps and so on. So this covers the interference. So in the de Broglie-Bohm model, you do know which slit the particle went through. If the particle is detected on the left of the screen, it went through the left slit. And if it's detected on the right of the screen, it went through the right slit. Of course, there's no way of actually verifying that without making a measurement earlier. And if you make a measurement, you'll disturb all this, so you won't see interference. So you'd be doing a different experiment. It's one of the problems of the de Broglie-Bohm model. It gives you these beautiful pictures, and yet you don't know if you should believe them or not. Because if you look, then... Anyway. Okay. So I'm going to move on to measurement in the de Broglie-Bohm model. Any questions on trajectories?
Yeah. Just, if you slice this thing horizontally, would you get exactly the same interference that is predicted by?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, assuming you start off initially with an equilibrium distribution, so with your distribution of particle positions according to psi squared, then yeah, you would get exactly the same predictions as quantum theory. So this reproduces quantum theory. So let's imagine now we want to make a measurement in a Laperouse bound model. And this the measurement theory was really the contribution of David Bohm. And it's only when you consider measurement that the whole model starts to make sense, really. So we'll consider we have a particle like this one. So maybe it was initially in some Gaussian, then it hits a barrier, potential barrier, and gets split into two pieces. So the wave function at this point where it's been split into two pieces has a term corresponding to being on the left, and a term corresponding to being on the right. So this is like so. We'll assume that these two terms barely overlap. If they're Gaussian sufficiently far away, that's a good approximation. Now we want to introduce a measurement apparatus. So imagine that this particle hits a measurement apparatus. I have some box. The particle comes in. Okay, here's the particle coming in to the box. Its position somewhere. The box has a pointer on it. Okay, the pointer is initially pointing in the zero direction, and then the pointer, we design the measurement apparatus so the pointer will go to the left if it detects the particle on this side, and it will go to the right if it detects the particle on this side. Okay. So what that means is, we'll say this pointer here is described by a y variable. So the position for the pointer, the position variable for the pointer is y. And the pointer is in some initial state. We'll call it phi zero. So this should evolve to some new pointer position, so some new pointer state. This corresponds to the pointer now being on the left. And we're assuming that this measurement happens fairly quickly, so we can ignore the evolution of the particle itself. It wouldn't be very much of a complication to include that evolution. And then likewise, we have that Okay. Is that clear? So if we start off in this state, our initial state is alpha is alpha this plus beta, now a term initial state is that. And then we want to let this interaction happen with the measurement apparatus. So that evolves to something similar, except now the pointer has gone into, has got entangled. Now, one thing I didn't mention, and it's important and actually quite subtle for, I mean, it ends up being quite interesting in the de Broglie-Bohm model, is that we want to assume that the wave packets associated with these two different pointer positions are non-overlapping in position space. So that's the position this way. So this can only be true if wherever this wave packet is non-zero, this one is more or less zero, and vice versa. Okay. So these wave packets are non-overlapping. This is a stronger assumption than assuming that they're merely orthogonal in the usual sense in quantum theory. Yeah. This what this means is that if you take the product of those wave packets and integrate, you get zero. Whereas this requires them to be zero, one of them to be zero, one or the other of them to be zero for each value of y. Okay. So an example where this is true, but this is not true, would be if you had some particles in a well, and you had the ground state, and then you had the first excited state. So these two wave packets, if you integrate the product, you get zero. Okay, so this is a requirement for measurement to work out in the de Broglie-Bohm model. And if you don't do this, if you just have this but not this, there's a phenomena, there's an effect in the de Broglie-Bohm model which goes by the name of surrealistic trajectories. I'm not sure I'm going to have time to explain that, but if you're interested in that, if you look in the literature for surrealistic de Broglie-Bohm trajectories, or surrealistic Bohmian trajectories, I think, then you'll find out that you can exploit if you have this situation, then your detector doesn't kind of do what you expect it to do. Okay. So now let's sketch what happens. I want to sketch the de Broglie-Bohm trajectories. Okay, this is going to test the limits of my artistic abilities. So let's draw a graph. I want to have x, the app, this is the Bohmian position, the actual position of the de Broglie Bohm particle that's coming in. And then y is the actual position of the pointer. And then we have time on the vertical axis. And so, so you can imagine that at time zero, we have this superposition here. Psi is equal to, psi is equal to alpha psi A plus beta psi B. And then we also have the particle, the pointer, kind of in its zero position initially. So initially the pointer is sort of here, roughly, sort of going to be some Gaussian here. The I'm just kind of just sketching. I'm just trying to give you an idea. And the particles. So what we'll have is actually have at this initial time we'll have two. The wave function will have two parts. One where the pointer is in B. Sorry, not the pointer. The particle, the particle that's being measured is in wave packet B, or it's in wave packet A, and then the pointer is in the zero position. Okay. So it's zero, and this is sort of A and B for the particle. Then we're also going to have A for the pointer over here, and B for the pointer. I'm going to change the order of those. A here, B here. So let me just draw a kind of square to help me construct this. And now I want to evolve in time. So I'm going to evolve that, take that square. Not the best drawing. So the original square has, four quarters, and the wave functions are here and here. Now what's going to happen is as you evolve, you'll have a part of the wave function appear here, and a part of the wave function appear here at the top. This one will evolve here, and this one will evolve here. So viewed from the side, this one is going backwards, and this one is coming forwards. Okay. If I was to look at the wave packet for earlier times, before it hit the potential barrier, then you'd have something like this. Okay. So. The Gaussian comes in, hits the potential barrier, gets split. Then you make a measurement, and then if you're getting the A result, the wave packet goes backwards. If you get the B result, the wave packet comes forwards. Okay, so that's a sketch of what's happening. And now we can draw the particle trajectories. So a particle trajectory that is going to end up in this wave packet does this. One that's going to end up in this wave packet does this. And of course, there's a lot more. Not doing a very good job here. Okay, you can draw lots of these trajectories. So you'll have a whole bunch of trajectories doing this and a whole bunch of trajectories doing that. Okay. Is any questions on that before I move? Yep, go ahead.
Can you repeat what's the bottom like part of the wave packet?
This bit here.
The one.
So you see up there, I had a Gaussian hit a potential barrier, and then split into two pieces. So that's one way you can prepare this initial state here, is to have a barrier. So I was just drawing the initial state being some Gaussian. It hits a barrier, and it divides into two parts before it interacts with the pointer.
Ah, so it's moving kind of upwards.
Yeah, this is moving upwards, yeah. So up until the interaction with the measurement operators is turned on, everything is vertical in this plane.
I see.
Okay. And then when the interaction is turned on, it starts to, the pointer starts to move. So one leg is going forwards out of the page, out of the blackboard. One is going backwards.
Okay.
Okay, so now you might imagine that actually the pointer is a very big system, and so it consists of lots of particles. So where n is, you know, the roughly something macroscopic, the number of so Avogadro's number, so these will be all the particles in the pointer. You might even want to include particles in the environment which interact with the pointer. Okay, so then, you know, n would become very big, and so that's hard to draw because I don't have 10 to the 23 axes on this picture, but roughly the same thing is going to happen. You'll get this kind of behavior. And if you have this number of particles, then you can ask, is it possible to make this wave packet and this wave packet ever overlap again? Okay, so I've got a wave packet here and a wave packet here. If I've just got one particle, you could imagine designing an experiment which would make this wave packet and this wave packet overlap again, and you'd have quantum interference. But now we've got 10 to the power 23 particles, and so all behaving, you know, in different ways, especially the ones in the environment. And so you're asking, can I build an interference device that will bring them back together, re-overlap these wave packets, and that becomes essentially impossible, or impossible for all practical purposes. It's very hard to have that kind of control for that number of particles. And so that means that once you're in, say, this wave packet, this is the A outcome, and now you've got 10 to the 23 particles in this direction, then you no longer care about this wave packet. So if you want to calculate the velocity, the velocity of any of the particles, let's say the x particle or the y particle, or y particles, any of the y particles, then the equation is the guidance equation, which is h bar over this is the total wave function, this uppercase psi. Then you have something similar for each of the y particles, similar expression, an m. Let's think about if the particle is over here, and we do this calculation, then you can see that the guidance, that the velocity we get, doesn't depend on what's happening to the wave function over here. Okay. It doesn't depend on it because, well, all the particles are over here. So when you evaluate this, here, then it is not seeing what the wave function is on the other side. Okay. And so, what this means is, if you want to simplify your life, if you know the particle is in this wave packet, then you can just use this effective wave function. So you can say, the effective wave function is so if your outcome is that the your pointer was in the support of the wave function associated with the A outcome, then this becomes your effective wave function, and you can ignore the other term over there. And likewise, if your outcome is on the other side, then this becomes your effective wave function. And so what this means is that even though the wave function doesn't actually collapse, you've recovered the projection postulate. You have effective collapse of the wave function. Okay. So far as all future dynamics are concerned, if you have this outcome, then you can ignore this part of the wave function. Yeah, go ahead.
Did you write phi of alpha again in the bottom?
Did I mix? Yeah, I did. Yeah, so that should be a B. Was that your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the projection postulate is recovered. Any other questions? Yeah, go ahead.
If you start with the assumption that the wave packets don't intersect at all, which appears to be a conclusion from this picture here, because they're not allowed to cross.
The wave packets can cross, the trajectories can't cross.
These are trajectories, but yeah. There's a probability associated with these trajectories. So once you're on one side, you can't cross to the other side. So the probability, if you're here, of being over there is zero, and likewise.
Yeah.
So you start off with basically it appears the rule that you cannot have intersection between these probabilities.
Yeah.
And once you know where the particle is, then don't you necessarily know that the other wave function is zero? You don't have to say you assume it's not there.
I mean, the model tells you that the wave function is not zero; it's still there, and it's part of the ontic state. That's because the wave function evolves according to Schrodinger's equation, so it continues to be there. So from an ontological point of view,
but it has a value of zero for wave.
But it has a value, so the ontology is a wave function, which has arguments, x and y, and then particles having actual positions, and you have to think of the wave function as being a real thing itself in this model, as well as the particle positions being real things. So the wave function is really there. In that example there, you can see the trajectories. So one way you know something is real is if you can bump into it. And in this case here, a particle that's coming along here bumps into the wave packet that came this way. It's harder to bump into the wave packet here because of decoherence and all these particles. So for all practical purposes, it's not doing anything. In principle, if you had smart enough technology, you could in principle, bump into it, like I'm saying. But, okay. So, let's see. I want to discuss, so that's measurement. I want to discuss non-locality. So I discussed this a little bit already, but let me, I think there's some things I didn't say before. So the velocity of either, if you have two particles, imagine we have two particles, so we have two particles, one and two, then the velocity of particle one, for example, is a function that depends. This function depends on the wave function. It's some function of the positions of the two particles. So the velocity of particle one depends on the position of particle two. And what you could imagine doing is jiggling particle two and the way to do that in quantum theory would be to use the potential. So the potential for the two particles, you could think of it as being some potential acting on particle one plus some potential acting on particle two. Imagine particle one is over here. So particle one is here somehow. Particle two is, you know, as far away as you like, could be over here. And now I can vary the potential acting on particle two. If I do that, it will affect the wave function and thereby affect the small x2, and that will get communicated to the motion of the particle x2, and therefore it's going to affect the velocity of x1. Okay. However, if your wave function is not entangled, then you don't see this non-local effect. So it's a product state, then the velocity for V1 is equal to H bar over M1. And now we have, let's put this in. So we have phi x1, sorry, psi x1, phi x1. So that's the expression. But now you can see, because we're just taking this derivative on x1, it doesn't do anything to this. This just is a constant from the point of view of that. So this and this cancel, and I forgot to put stars here. And likewise, this and this cancel. And so we're just left with the equation for a particle 1. And so when we have a product state, the velocity of particle 1 doesn't depend on particle 2. And likewise, the velocity of particle 2 doesn't depend on particle 1. That's a nice kind of consistency, or it's a nice property for the model to have. If it didn't have that model, I think it would be unsavory. Okay, and then I mentioned this on Wednesday, but if over here, if you do have an entangled state, then you have rho equal to psi squared, so you have this equilibrium distribution, then you can't actually use that to signal faster than the speed of light in this model. However, if you have rho not equal to psi squared, then in general you can use it to signal. So the model is in that case, explicitly non-local. It violates that basic principle. Okay. Right, let me just finish on the de Broglie-Bohm model now and write a few criticisms. Okay, so four criticisms. I like the fourth criticism the most. So first of all, I mentioned this before, you don't actually need the guidance equation. If you're interested in making predictions, okay, you can get all the empirical stuff from the guidance equation. The only place I've seen that questioned is in the case of time of arrival, but I couldn't tell you if I believe those claims or not. So given that we don't need the guidance equation to make predictions, why would anyone ever bother to do those calculations? Okay. Question two. Where does the guidance equation come from? I mean, you can motivate it and even derive it under various assumptions, but it does look like you've got this very beautiful theory. The wave function, then you have this bolt-on equation. Criticism three, which I also mentioned, which is that there's no back reaction. of the particles on the waves. So the waves affect the particles, but the particles don't affect the waves. Okay. And then criticism number four. Criticism number four is it's subject to the many worlds in denial attack. This criticism is due, I think, initially to David Deutsch and then developed by Harvey Brown and David Wallace. The many worlds in denial attack. And this goes back to some remarks I was making a bit earlier. So according to the ontology of the de Broglie-Bohm model, the wave function itself is real, just like the particle trajectories are real. It's a real thing. It's dangerous sometimes. The word real has two meanings in quantum foundations. It might mean that it's not complex, or it might mean that it's sort of ontologically present. I mean ontologically present. The wave function is a real thing in this interpretation. And then you have a situation like this, where imagine if you got a measurement outcome A, then this part of the wave function continues to be real. It continues to be there, but it has no influence over our lives. The rest of the universe, for the rest of time, this part of the wave function will do nothing. And that's true even though this wave function contains kind of stories about the future. So imagine we can make our system a bit more complicated and include not just the measurement device and this, but include, you know, some, maybe the rest of the world. And then we imagine, just to make it stark, imagine we have a building contractor who is a fan of quantum theory. And so he makes a quantum measurement and uses that measurement to decide whether or not he's going to build some high-rise skyscraper. Okay. If it comes out A, he won't build it. And if it comes out B, then he will build it. And let's imagine he gets outcome A, so he doesn't build the skyscraper. Nevertheless, the wave function over here, this part of the wave function, will contain the story of this skyscraper that's being built, and all the people moving in and having nice lives or whatever in this skyscraper. So that's all there. And furthermore, the wave function is a real thing. So in some sense, that all that story is really happening. And so the problem for the de Broglie-Bohm model is to say, why isn't this as real? You know, if it's there, it's in the wave function. It's a real story. Why isn't it as real as this part of the story, where the particle is? And in philosophy, there's a subject called functionalism. It's often used when thinking about the problem of consciousness. And according to functionalism, if you have, in that context, if you have maybe you have some computing process, which is our brain, which is based on carbon, then you believe it's conscious. And if you have the same kind of process but instantiated rather than in carbon, in silicon, then because it's the same process, then you should also have consciousness in that case. So the idea is that the particular substance that's used is not as important as the process itself. And so the same is happening here. So it's not about consciousness in this case, but it's about reality. The trajectories are one thing that's real, but you also have a story here in the wave function. And so that according to functionalism, should be something that's really happening as well. And this is the many worlds interpretation. Basically, the many worlds interpretation says, well, you have these processes happening in all parts of the wave function, and so they're all real, and the trajectory becomes irrelevant. This is a nice place to think about zombies. Because what you want to believe in the de Broglie-Bohm model is that what really our conscious experience, if you like, let's say, goes into the branch where there are trajectories. In the story I told, there was no skyscraper. And in the other branch, even though all the structure is there, the people who inhabit that branch are zombies. They have no conscious experience there. Mindless hulks, to use another expression from philosophy. So I think that's a really serious problem for the de Broglie-Bohm model. I still like the de Broglie-Bohm model, but I think it's a serious problem. So next time I'm going to talk about the many worlds interpretation, which I think has its own problems. So we'll see that. Okay. Any questions?